Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 7th of July, 2013. This would be installment number 5 under the NB73 series, which is generically titled Where the Nightmare Ends. And as you know, this series, which I'm placing as installments, which I'm presenting as installments, also doubles as a travelogue commentary, Travels with the Turton. So for the 5th installment, I've chosen the title Incompletion with Idris. I don't mean to throw anyone off here, but there's bound to be occasional jumbling in the sequence of these briefings and confusion about how I title them. The reason being, of course, that I'm doing this in real time. I'm dancing with the currents as they come my way. So, to be perfectly clear, installment number 4 in this series, which I initially titled Sophia's Magnificat, now goes out under the title Forensic Astronomy. So that was the last briefing, which went out yesterday. This one, the 5th in the series, Incompletion with Idris, and then the 6th in the series will be again titled Sophia's Magnificat. So I'm definitely returning to that theme, that leitmotif, because Sophia's Magnificat is the leitmotif of this moment in the 3 years of correction, this unique moment. Now, my assistant who posts the MP3 files on GaiaSpore.org has kindly set up the previous installment with illustrations and links that I provided. So let me just show you what's there. You click on the little square which says forensic code. It's a JPEG entitled Forensic Code, and you get a full readout of this code. Now remember that I said forensic astronomy is not astrology, even though it may use the astrological signs as locational tools. It does not in any respect draw upon the massive body of conventional astrological meanings and symbols and interpretations and so forth. So what you see here is purely a code I've devised for research in forensic astronomy. At the same time, this code is valuable to crew of the GNE because it can be used as an annotation for particular moments. It encodes not only the timing of an event, but the planetary and lunar and sidereal factors that pertain to that timing. So, S68I29 divided by a period. This means on the 68th day of summer, on the 29th day of Idris. That corresponds to July 7th, 2013, today, and it is now 10:15 in the morning here in Belgium. The line of code reads, sunrise crescent. How do you know it's the sunrise crescent and not the sunset crescent? Sunrise crescent appears at the end of a shift in the eastern sky, and the sunset crescent appears the beginning of a shift in the western sky. A simple rule of thumb for observational astronomy says that the form of the sunset crescent corresponds to the right hand. If you form a crescent shape with the index finger and thumb of your right hand, the form of the sunrise crescent conforms to the shape of the left hand. So this is a left-handed crescent with the concave part facing to the right. Okay? Sunrise crescent in the aphelion of the moon in 2 degrees of Cancer, equivalent to the perihelion of Saturn. You see that? The A, and the way I draw the A is with that characteristic long arm. That's the symbol for lunar apogee. The lunar apogee is in 2 degrees of Cancer. The colon indicates an equivalence. So that means that that location is equivalent to the perihelion of Saturn. And when the perihelia of the planets are indicated in a code, we draw a line under them because they represent a special kind of data. The perihelia of the planets are not comparable to the apogee and perigee of the moon. So we emphasize that. You can emphasize that by drawing a line under the symbols for those elements. I'm just trying to see if I can get that background buzz out of the recording. Okay, it seems to be gone. To continue, there is a right-facing bracket, okay? And that bracket is the kind of symbol taken from, it is a symbol taken from calculus, and it's the symbol used in deriving determination sets, I think they're called, in calculus. Determinants, yes. When you lay out a set of determinants in calculus, you use this bracket, this tall right-facing bracket. The right-facing bracket in the code of forensic astronomy refers to the inclusion of transiting planets. You see, nothing in the first part of this formula refers to a transiting planet, except the moon, which is not a planet, but a satellite of the Earth. So we use the calculus bracket to separate, to distinguish a second set of data, and that is Jupiter is exact in the position stated. The E means that Jupiter is exact, and the parenthesis facing back toward the other data indicates that Jupiter is exactly in that position, namely 2 Cancer. Jupiter exact in 2 Cancer plus Saturn stationary direct in 5 Scorpio. So what you understand from the tall bracket is that anything that follows the tall bracket is going to show you transiting planets. What are transiting planets? They are the planets of the solar system in their actual position now in real time. Jupiter now is just moving into the twins, stationed at the lunar apogee. And Saturn is in a stationary direct. It's stationary, which means it's not moving at all, but once it begins to move again, it will move forward. That is to say, Saturn is at the end of its 5-month retrograde period, and at the point where it reaches the conclusion of its retrograde motion, it stands in a certain degree of the zodiac, in this case, 5 degrees of Scorpio. So this is how I would read the code. Sunrise crescent in the apogee of the moon in 2 degrees of Cancer, corresponding to the perihelion of Saturn, with the transiting Jupiter exactly in the same degree and the transiting Saturn stationary direct in 5 degrees of Scorpio. Now, there's an alternative way you could write this. Instead of using these sign notations from astrology, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, Leo, Virgo, Libra, Scorpio, Sagittarius, Capricorn, and Pisces, which are 30-degree sections of the ecliptic, you could use the 360-degree scale of the ecliptic. So you could say ECL 92. So you could say sunrise crescent in the apogee of the moon, ECL 92. That is to say the 92nd degree on the 360-degree scale. And that would mean the same thing as 2 Cancer. Likewise, you could say ECL 215, which is the same as 5 degrees of the sign Scorpio. Finally, not to be too tedious about this, I just want to point out that when your eyes scan this notation, which is both a mathematical and a graphic notation, you might want to take account of those points in the notation, those items of data which are observable and those are not, and those which are not, because it mixes the two. So the sunrise crescent is observable, but the apogee of the moon is not observable, nor is the perihelion of Saturn, except that you can picture where they stand in the starry background of the constellations, but they themselves are non-observable points. Jupiter is, of course, observable, and Saturn is observable. So something that you could do in the learning stage, if you would like to do so, if you would write out a line of code like this for some upcoming event in the GNE, on a second line beneath these symbols and numbers, you could write the graphic component of the constellation. So, for instance, in this case, I could have written beneath A to Cancer, twins, or even feet of twins. And I could have written beneath Saturn SD 5 Scorpio, Virgin, or even knee of the Virgin. So you can actually annotate the code according to your observations of the sky to familiarize yourself with translating back and forth between the first and second attention, that is to say, conception and visualization. You conceive of the lunar apogee, and you perceive a planet or the moon standing in the apogee, but you visualize the constellations in their graphic form. To be even more precise, you perceive the star pattern of the constellations. That's a perception, just like you were standing in a field looking at a grove of trees, and you perceive the individual trees, and maybe you even perceive that they stand in some kind of relation to each other. They may form some kind of pattern. Likewise, you directly observe and perceive the composite of a constellation, but when you call it the twins or the virgin, you add to that perception a visualization. And this is quite simply the technique of naked eye mythology, as I dubbed it many years ago. So, I guess you could call that forensic astronomy 101. I just might add in passing that the crucial thing to learn, which is going to help you a lot, those of you who are somewhat daunted or intimidated by this kind of language, the crucial thing to learn is that there are two sets of nomenclature for signs and constellations. And I believe that if you go to the sky lore section of metahistory.org, where I presented some of the chapters of Quest for the Zodiac, you will see a list that explains the 12 names from conventional astrology, which are Greco-Latin terms: Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer. These are Greco-Latin words. They refer to the starless divisions of the ecliptic, which are each equal to 30 degrees. And they are useful for a locational grid. But you can't observe Aries, Taurus, Gemini, or Cancer. You can't observe them. They're non-observable. You learn 13 other terms: ram, bull, twins, crab, lion. Crab, not Cancer. Lion, not Leo. I call these the storybook names. You learn the storybook names of the observable constellations. And then you have both systems, which you can use simultaneously. For instance, I would say to someone, typically in an astrological session, say someone who was born today, July 7th of any year, okay, you're born with a sun in the 16th degree of Cancer. That is on the ecliptic scale, that is in the framework of the astrological signs. So you are a Cancer by sign, but you have the sun in the constellation of the twins, in the upper torso. And both things are true. The first information belongs to your personality and the analysis of your personal behavior and your psychological profile and various complexes of your personal identity. The second part of the designation, the sun in the torso, upper torso of the twins, refers to something that is entirely transpersonal. And it's as simple as that. So if you learn these two sets of terms, the 12 names of the signs, which you already know, and the 13 storybook names of the constellations, the 13th one being Snake Tamer, because there are 13 constellations, not 12. Now I'm going back for a moment to the Gaia Spora Nav Briefings page, where Simon has kindly set up the fourth installment under NB 73. And you see that there's a link there to the Destiny of the Swan Knight. And what comes up on that page in metahistory.org is the profile portrait of Lohengrin by Ernst Fuchs. You see that Lohengrin is actually wearing a swan, a kind of swan crown. Lohengrin is known as the Swan Knight. And the content of that essay, Destiny of the Swan Knight, fills in on much of the material I presented in the last couple of briefings. Simon has also linked to a YouTube clip of the opening of Parsifal by Wagner. Now, this is just the instrumental without singing. I don't listen to operas. I can't stand opera. So I've never listened to an opera by Wagner. I have never listened to the operatic version of Parsifal. I have listened to some parts of the instrumental, the orchestral versions. And I have to say that I'm not particularly thrilled by this piece. I find it somewhat pompous. It's slow, and it doesn't really move me very much, but it is very moody, very deep. It has some sublime aspects to it, perhaps some innuendos of sublimity. And it will give you an idea of the orchestral composition of Richard Wagner, which uses this method of leitmotifs. I've also included another piece of music to compare, and that is the Liebestod, or the love-death passage from Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. Now, this is altogether a different kick. This is certainly one of the pieces of music that I've followed in my life, listened to many times. Tristan and Isolde was also a favorite of Sabina Spielrein, who was the first mistress of C.G. Jung. And she loved this Wagnerian music and identified deeply with the heroines and heroes in Wagner's operas. So there you have what some commentators have called one of the more erotic pieces of music that was ever written. The Liebestod, or Love Death, is the culminating scene of Tristan and Isolde, in which the two lovers die together. And, well, there you go. Listen, and you may like it, you may find it unbearable. Wagner is not for everyone. I don't think it's even an acquired taste. I think you would run away screaming from Wagner if you didn't like this particular kind of music. It's extremely syrupy and that's not to everyone's taste. But whether you like it or not, I think it's inarguable that the concluding passage of Tristan and Isolde could be called a musical orgasm. No question about that. Also, I just want to make a comment, since I'm up here in Europe, and the eagle has landed in Belgium, the American eagle, who flies over Europe. I want to make a comment about the few images that are presented here in the montage on the YouTube clip for Tristan and Isolde. For instance, the image you see in the still, this blonde or red-headed version of Isolde, Tristan with his harp sitting nearby. These are, of course, classical images out of Northern European culture, and they represent not only a personality type of the Middle Ages, but they also represent a physical type. The physical type that is associated with both Teutonic and Celtic mythology and legend. You know, you have to say that Tristan and Isolde, although it's written by a German in Middle High German, Gottfried von Strasbourg, is actually a story of Celtic hero Tristan and his beloved Isolde, and they're Irish. So when you get into that area of European culture and literature, you find a mingling and merging of the Celtic and Teutonic strains, as it were. I come purely out of the Celtic strain. Well, not purely. I'm a half-breed, the other half being Italian. But as far as my Irish genes go, I come out of the Celtic stream, and I have great affinity and respect for the Teutonic stream. As you know, I hold the fate of Germany strongly in my heart these days. I'd really like to do something about that. And I am heartbroken about what has been done to the German people and about the lies that have been told about the German people from the First World War onward. But I just want to say that when you see these images that come up in the montage over Tristan and Isolde, bear in mind that these stately, noble-looking people who are blonde or dark-haired and of fair complexion, these people, this family of the Anthropos, the Aryan family, consisting of two main subfamilies, the Celtic and Teutonic, is an endangered species. Look at these fairy tale characters, and look at the beauty and poise and power of their form and figure. There is someone who does not want that kind of beauty and power to survive on this planet. As I said before, and get yourself really clear on Lash's position on this, I think race mixing is a great kick, and I would like to taste as many lovely ladies of as many races as come my way. But the agenda of forced integration and race mixing on a massive scale is a tool of social and genetic destruction and needs to be opposed in every conceivable manner. If I want to go and mingle with a Cambodian woman, or if I want to go and mingle with a Norwegian girl, then that's my choice and my passion as an individual animal. And I would look for an equivalent desire from the woman. And that is bound to happen sometimes, and it can lead to amazingly beautiful results. It can lead to an enrichment for all the races, for there to be a selective race mixing based on true affinities and true passions. I'm a result of it. I know what I'm talking about. I'm a result of a Celtic and Italian race mix. But to force race mixing on people and to forcefully integrate people and to enforce agendas of immigration, as they're doing now, doing in Europe for many years, as they're doing now in Scandinavia, which is absolutely ruining the country, ruining the Scandinavian countries. These policies derive from the enemies of the whole human race who want to see racial and national identity destroyed. And that is the battlefront right now. And there is a reaction happening to that. And I stand on the ramparts. I do not want to see the racial identity and cultural and ethnic identity of any European peoples be destroyed. On the contrary, I want to see them to celebrated for their uniqueness and for the excellence that each of them brings to this experiment. So I feel really passionately about this. And I'm also in a kind of alarm regarding this topic. As I've said before, I never thought I'd reach the point in my life where I would consider that I belong to an endangered species, but I do. In fact, all species of all colors are endangered by the agenda of forced race mixing. And you have to go and look very closely and ask yourself, who's behind that agenda? And when you see who's behind that agenda, you'll also note a remarkable fact, that those who push that agenda themselves do not follow it. Those who push that social agenda within their own family or tribe are rigorously opposed to any race mixing outside their tribe. So consider that hypocrisy and consider why any race or family of people on this planet would enforce upon the rest of humanity rules that it does not observe for itself. So I'm going to leave that horrible, disgusting topic right where it is for now, and in the remaining 45 minutes of this reading, try to be a little more upbeat and inspirational. I didn't have any idea I'd be making this briefing until I woke up this morning at about 4 a.m. Went outside and stood on the terrace behind the house, looking up at the sky. It was still dark, just before dawn, and I couldn't see the sunrise crescent because there's not a clear view of the horizon, and it's probably too thin already to be visible. The exact moment of the conclusion of the Idris shift of 2013 is 7:15 Universal Time on Monday the 8th. So, I was out there and I experienced or witnessed this morning something that is quite rare here in Belgium and in Northern Europe in general, and that is to say, a crystal clear sky without the slightest sign of a cloud. And as I stand here right now, at 11 o'clock in the morning, 7 hours later, I can say that the sky on this bright, sunny Sunday in Belgium is absolutely impeccably clear. The color of the sky is a light blue, which is suggestive also of a powder blue, or I would even say a kind of blue talc. And I would venture the observation that the sky here in Northern Europe, as well as in lots of other places in the world, is taking on a talc-y look. Now, you would know why. That might be happening right now, wouldn't you? Due to geoengineering, which has been going on for a long time, it appears that there is an enduring effect which has lightened up or toned up the blue of the sky. Nevertheless, it is remarkable, even though the sky is not as dark blue as I would like it to be, and certainly not as dark blue as it was when I first came to Belgium 22 years ago. Nevertheless, this is a remarkable day. There is not a single cloud. There is a perfect cloudless dome over this little Flemish village, reaching out to the horizon, to the flatlands on all sides. And when I stood out there this morning at 4 a.m., I was struck by some kind of preternatural stillness in the air. There are a lot of trees in this village and around the houses and on the lawns and behind the lawns. There are tall, tall poplar trees. There are two big pine trees in the backyard of this house. And the birds were starting to sing, and there's lots of birds around. There are croaking ravens, turtle doves, swallows, finches, blackbirds, robin redbreasts, all kinds of birds activity. So the bird choruses were beginning at 4 in the morning, and I stood there feeling the stillness. The air was absolutely still. The silhouettes of the trees looking toward the east were like frozen, as if they were made of metal, as if they were metallic constructions. And I went over to the honeysuckle, which runs along the wall of the backyard, and looked closely at the flowers and leaves of the honeysuckle. And the honeysuckle plant in that early light could have been made of metal. It could have been forged and constructed out of metal and painted to look like a plant. There was a particular metallic stillness to everything. The other thing that I noticed standing there in the dark or half dark is that I had a sensation at moments. It kind of drifted in and out. It wasn't steady. But I had a sensation that I was 30 feet tall, and that the buildings around me were equivalently magnified. So I was standing there looking down at a bucket on the ground with some rainwater in it taken from the well beside the shed. And I saw that I was not just 5'10½, but I was maybe 6 times larger, looking down at the bucket. But the bucket did not appear unusually small, because the bucket was also 6 times larger. So I had this weird sensation that I was this massive creature, exactly as I am now, exactly with all the physical details of my form and figure down to my eyelashes. And how long would my eyelashes be if I was 6 times taller than I am now? Well, that's the kind of eyelashes I had this morning. Now, make of that what you will. That's an impression that I wanted to report to the crew. So I sat there and had a cup of coffee out on the terrace in the pre-dawn light. And as I just sat there in the silence, in silent knowing. That is to say, gently, not suppressing, because if you suppress it, it comes back stronger, but gently letting the interior monologue just fade away, ignoring it. Ignoring it as if it were some white noise. Because I knew that I didn't want to think of anything at that moment. At moments like that, you don't want to think. At moments like that, you want to turn the mental radio off or allow it to shut itself off, which is a subtle practice. My acquaintance with that practice goes back to my encounter with Chan Buddhism when I was in my early 20s. So I allowed that to happen, and lo and behold, some thoughts came to me out of the well of silent knowing. And they come, when they do come in that manner, they come in with a certain force and definition and clarity that is startling. And you know that this is not originally your thought, even though it appears to be something that arises in your mind like the sound of mental radio. But no, it's not. It's some other kind of subliminal activity underneath the mental radio. And I felt a kind of shock, and I thought to myself, now here is my mentation, my mental paraphrase of what came to me in silent knowing at that moment. Holy moly! I can see what the next paradigm shift of science has to be. And I'm going to correct it. Correct that language. It's a pretty accurate translation, but correct it and say, no, the next jolt, there has to be a jolt, there can be, there may be, there has to be a jolt in the scientific paradigm or set of scientific paradigms that the human species is currently using to try to explain the cosmology of time and space. And what is that paradigm jolt? It comes from Idris, and it is a jolt of a double blow. It is a blow into the human conception of historical time over the large-scale, long-term geological periods, and it is a blow into the very structure of linear time itself. And I glimpsed something at that moment that shocked and delighted me. I glimpsed the possibility that something could happen in science regarding the scientific understanding of time, which, by the way, is, I don't even have a word for it. It's pathetic. And no one that I know of is really paying attention to the problem of our concept of time. But something could happen to the paradigms scientists use to understand time that would produce a total rescaling of geological time. And as a result of that rescaling, and this is the sensational part, it would come to be obvious that everything concerning the Earth in its evolution and in its cosmological development, as well as the presence of the human species on the Earth, happened a lot more recently than we currently think, a lot more recently. And so this paradigm jolt delivered from the power of Idris, who oversees fate and the mysteries of time, would blow open the human mind into a more accurate understanding of the time frame of the Earth itself. For instance, I'll give you an example. I wrote an essay on medhistory.org about the Gaia's age, and I called it an idiosyncratic calculation. Now, according to that calculation, in order to produce that calculation, let me say, I relied provisionally and tentatively on the accepted geological time frame. That time frame states that the Earth began to form 4 billion 320 million years ago, or 4.3 or 4.5 billion years ago. So the current paradigm says the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. And as Socrates said in the Gorgias, if we're going to have a conversation about anything, we have to have provisional definitions that we use, but they're just provisional. They are just tools to get the conversation going. They're not absolute. So I used that calculation, and I came to the conclusion that the age of Sophia would be about 23 years old. Now, I stick to that, by the way. You can quote me on that. And I am convinced that even if there were a rescaling and downscaling of time, so that all geological periods, starting from 4.5 billion years ago, were collapsed forward toward the present moment, even so, within that rescaled model, she would still be of the age of about 23. That doesn't change, because the proportions of the scaling would remain the same. You know, when you try to use that standard geological time frame, or try to graft it onto the Sophianic cosmology of the mysteries, you run into a lot of trouble. First of all, you have to ask yourself, well, if the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, well, how old is the solar system? Because the Sophianic cosmology says that the solar system existed long before Sophia morphed into the Earth. And it gets even worse, because not only was the solar system of the Archons, the celestial mechanics and Disney World of the Archons, their theme park, produced by Sophia's plunge long before the Earth appeared, there were even two Archonic planetary systems, and the first one collapsed. So the Archonic planetary system in which the Earth is now captured is not the original Archonic planetary system, the first one that she allowed them to construct, conferring upon them a spark of her divine intelligence so that she could model that Archonic system on the patterns of the Pleromic Aeons, as the Nag Hammadi texts explain in vivid detail. No, that one collapsed. They couldn't maintain it. Even though she gave them the power to construct it, they couldn't maintain the construction, and it collapsed. And the remnants of the construction of that first Archonic world system, or first Archonic stereoma, are seen in the planet Saturn and in the rings of Saturn. And the difference between the current planetary system in which the Earth is captured and the previous one before the Earth existed is that in the current one, the Sun is the center and Saturn defines the boundary of the planetary system. The orbit of Saturn defines the boundary. Whereas in the previous pre-terrestrial Archonic stereoma, something that is the equivalent to what Saturn is today was at the center. Saturn was the center or Archontic sun of the previous system that collapsed. Now, I am telling you on this day, on July 7, 2013, that everything that I am saying can and perhaps will be scientifically and astronomically verified when scientists have the paradigm jolt required to bring them into real thinking about how this world of ours came to exist. They are not in real thinking. They are in a make-believe fantasy world, deluded and confounded by mathematical fictions like black holes and quasars and string theory and quantum theory and all this garbage. If Idris were to deliver a jolt into the minds of some human animals engaged in science, maybe some young ones today, maybe some of those in the classroom of the thunderbolts people. That jolt would blow open the space of thinking for a totally new cosmological picture. And in that picture, it may turn out that the Earth was not formed 4.5 billion years ago, but something more like 45 million years ago. And that preceding the formation of the Earth, there would have been that first archontic stereoma, Saturn-centered archontic stereoma, which collapsed. So you would have this sequence. Sophia's plunge produces the archons, like Akari insects. They have no habitat. Sophia gives them the spark of intelligence to construct their own habitat, which collapses. Second chapter. The sun enters into interaction with the Aeon Sophia in the third galactic limb. The sun can be conceived not as a physical body, but as a whirlpool or eddy in the plasmic streaming of the galactic arm. So Sophia, still in her pre-planetary body of pure aeonic luminosity, is a current hovering in the third galactic arm, and her current merges with a massive plasmic eddy, that is the sun. The plasmic eddy gives Sophia a dwell point. Then she allows the Archons to construct another celestial mechanical Disney world centered on that plasmic eddy or vortex. So you would have then, also preterrestrial, the inclusion of the sun in the solar system and the creation of what we today recognize as the moon, because actually the moon existed before the Earth. And there is, in fact, scientific and astronomical investigation to support that view. So first archonic system collapsed, sun comes along, second archonic system constructed, more stable, centered on the dwell point of the sun. Sophia produces the moon as the first actual condensation of her organic luminosity, the pearl of organic light, and then eventually she herself morphs into the Earth. And so in the sequence sun, moon, Earth, she forms the three-body system of her dreaming. And that three-body system, or trimorphic protonoia, is captured in the celestial mechanics of the Archons. Such is the fate of humanity. The fate. So Idris is the mistress of fate. You and I, along with Idris, want to know what it takes to change the fate of humanity. Gaian sorcerers do not work on humanity at large. They do not go out and try to convince the masses of anything. I am not playing for a mass awakening on this planet. That is not what I do as a Gaian sorcerer. I work directly upon the fate of humanity, not upon the human condition. So that would be an enormous change of fate, and it would be an enormous kick. It would be an enormous acceleration of human evolution if that happened in Sophia's correction. Because the effect of scaling down the time scale into a much smaller period of time would tremendously intensify human awareness of the cosmological adventure in which we are involved. Anyway, at least that's how I see it. Now, I spoke of a second blow of Idris, and I'd like to describe exactly what that is. I've alluded to it already, I think, but I have to tell you there's a bit of a problem in translating or conferring to you the Dakini instruction of Idris. You know, I use the analogy of gaming, and It is a Kalika saying that if you can put any situation or problem in life into a gaming metaphor, you can master it instantaneously. And that's not so easy to do. Suppose, for instance, that you're in a troubled marriage. What gaming a metaphor would you apply to that situation? If you were able to do so, and this also is a method of Idris, if you were able to take the literal personal situation and the context and conditions of that situation, say a troubled marriage, and lock it into parallel with the metaphor of a game, calling it some kind of game and naming the game, you can instantly master that situation. This is a Kalika tactic of high initiatory realization. Now, consistent with that metaphor, I speak of Kali's Casino. You know that I myself am a dealer in Kali's Casino, don't you? And fate is a dealer's game. This is a saying from KaliRising.org. So just imagine that you go into Kali's Casino and there are various tables. Here's the roulette table, here's the baccarat, here's the blackjack. Craps over here. Whatever you want. And each of the Gayandakinis sits at one of these tables. Each of them has her own game. Vajrayogini, or Tantra Mother, has a game. Swandeva has a game. You can go sit at her table and play the game of Swandeva if you know the name of the game. So, well, I've been sitting at Idris' table in Kali's Casino off and on again over the last month. And I have to say, there's something that Idris does that's a bit disorienting, a bit peculiar. So I sit down at the table of Idris. She's sitting across from me. Now, I'm sitting there thinking, well, this is a bit of a challenge because if I want to game with Idris in the Kalika sense, I must name her game. She's not going to tell me what her game is. I have to name it. Okay? So, I can tell you what my game is because I'm not a Gayandakini. I'm a human animal tantrika employed in Kali's Casino, and my game is Diamond Black Jack. So I can tell you my game, but the Dakinis will not tell you their name or their game. You know that, don't you? You're getting it, aren't you? You're getting the kick of that. What a kick that is. They do that in respect for your freedom. So, this is what Idris does. As I said, it's a little bit disorienting. As I'm sitting there with my arm on the table, thinking, well, how am I going to begin gaming with Idris? She proceeds to show me a number of card tricks. She does play some kind of card game. And you know how people who deal in casinos, whether it be blackjack or some other card game, are very adept with handling the cards. And some of them know card tricks. So they have a particular way of shuffling the deck, and sometimes they flip cards and they play little tricks. They pull a card out of behind their neck or from behind their ear, or sometimes they lay the cards out, the whole deck out in the palm of the hand and flip it back and it runs all the way up the line of the arm. You've seen these kind of tricks, sleight of hand tricks. Idris loves these sleight of hand tricks with her cards. I think she has 10 cards in her deck. And she loves to sit there while I'm contemplating how to engage her and show me these card tricks. And what is my impression? What is my reaction? Well, it's the same as yours when you see anyone doing these tricks. It's like you're fascinated and you watch, but it happens too fast for you to see how it's done. Idris gives instruction in two of the greatest mysteries of the cosmos. One is the tenfold fractal internesting of the dimensions of time, and the second is the double. And I assure you that it is practically impossible within the range of human conception to hold a steady concept or thought regarding either of those two subjects. You cannot rationally grasp the dynamics of the double, nor can you rationally grasp or formulate the way that Idris breaks down the 10 dimensions of time, which are all emanations of Kali, and she herself is one of those emanations. But it's sort of like sitting there watching her play these card tricks gave me an opportunity to see how she does her tricks, how she breaks down the 10 dimensions of time. That is her second jolt. Her first jolt is to blow apart the restricting and erroneous paradigms that prevent science from seeing into the nature of geological and evolutionary time as it actually is. The second jolt is her breakdown of the 10 dimensions of time, and I'll give you a glimpse of what I saw as I observed her sleight of hand with the 10 cards she holds. The first thing Idris does is she takes the 10th card off the deck and lays it face down on the table. Or maybe it's face up. No, it would be face up. That is the illusion of linear time. 10. The 10th card is the illusion of linear time. Of course, I've said that it's Kali who removes the illusion of linear time. So is there a contradiction? No, because Idris is Kali. The 10 Mahavidyas are emanations of Kali. So when you sit down at the gaming table with Idris and she does a sleight of hand for you, she lays down card 10 face up. She has removed the illusion of the linear structure of time. Then she holds up the 9 cards and she takes the 9th card and slides it off the top of the deck and passes it across the casino to Merita. In other words, she actually takes one card out of her deck and saves it for Merita. She may actually give it to Merita or may she put it on the table face down. What card is that? That's card number 9. Why does she give her 9th card to Merita? Well, Merita and Idris share a common instruction in the Shakti cluster. As we knew in the wonderful Merita shift of this spring, Merita instructs humanity on how to resynchronize itself into harmony with all the cycles and biorhythms of the biosphere. She instructs in the construction of the Gaian calendar of the future. She instructs in the notations of the year with no new year, but with a continually recycling pattern of the 4 seasons intercalated with the lunar months correlated to the Shaktis. This is all the teaching of Merita, lovely meter maid. But Merita and Idris both realize that the human animal, as such, according to its animal life and according to its design as an animal, has been incorporated into the rhythms of the planet. So, you know, we have biorhythms as human animals. Man has a certain biorhythm cycle. A woman has another biorhythm cycle. And these biorhythm cycles flow and combine with the biorhythms of the planet itself. They do not propose that we rip ourselves out of that. On the contrary, they wish us to become harmoniously integrated into those natural time cycles. And so even though it's paradoxical, even though a human animal can begin to see beyond the illusions of linear time, which is card 10, because there are 10 fractal dimensions of time, we still need, as animals, to live in the harmonic natural rhythms of time. And so that is why Idris does a sleight of hand with a 9th card and hands it face down to Merita, because Merita will teach us how to live in the ninefold rhythms of human developmental time. And that ninefold rhythm can be seen in the developmental psychology that was introduced from the late 1970s into the beginning of the 1980s, in particular Daniel Stern, The Interpersonal World of the Infant. You will see in there the module or paradigms that show that the human animal develops organically and emotionally and intellectually on variations of a rhythm of nine. So the nine card goes to Merita. So that leaves 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now, Idris starts to deal you her hand, and she deals you two hands. These are called the two hands of Idris. She takes the remaining eight cards. She peels off six of those cards and places them face down on the table. She holds the remaining two cards, 7 and 8, in the palms of her hands. And she raises her hands vertically in front of you. The cards remain in her palms. They don't slide off. They remain there, and those are the two palms of Idris. Those are the two hands. That gesture of Idris, which you can find, by the way, in the gesture of the Ka in Egyptian iconography, you can find it in my book, Twins in the Double. The gesture of the Ka, the upholding of the two hands with palms facing outward, is the gesture of Idris. That way she offers you and invites you into her game. She looks at you with a clear and steady gaze between her two hands. And when you enter her game and you play with the two cards, 7 and 8, by that gambling, by that gaming process with just two cards, she teaches you to pick up each of the other six cards. You then, in her game, pick up each of these six cards when you have learned how and why to pick up those cards. And every time you pick up one of those cards, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, down to the Ace of Idris, you enter into a transcendental, illuminated consciousness of the fractal structure of time that is equivalent to that which the aeons themselves enjoy. And you cannot enter those fractal dimensions of awareness of time at the God level unless you do so in a state of high cognitive ecstasy. And unless you realize and live and test the experiences that become possible each time you turn up one of those six cards down to the last one, which is the Ace of Idris, which is eternity itself. The presence of eternity in each passing moment. Now, to conclude this briefing, again, in completion with Idris, remember what happens in completion. I just demonstrated it, didn't I? You can do it yourself and demonstrate it to yourself and demonstrate it among each other. And don't be intimidated. Don't worry about not knowing enough. It has nothing to do with not knowing enough. All you need is a few cues. Planetary Tantra, with its schema, provides those cues. all the elements of planetary tantra, any and all the elements, can work as a cueing device to release your spontaneous wisdom, the spontaneous wisdom of you, the magical child of the wisdom goddess. These demonstrations of spontaneous wisdom and of the magical and ludic understanding of life and time and space and anything you can name are yours. They're yours. That is what you are here to express, to discover and express. So in completion with Idris, the instruction of Idris becomes incorporated physically. She releases her nectar, which you drink from the cup of the sunrise crescent when it is in the balsamic condition. Balsam is elixir, and you drink it at the dark of the moon. So, to conclude in the mood of Idris and to round off this commentary of mine on her role as the mistress of fate, let's consider the fate of humanity. What is the fate of humanity? Well, the fate of humanity, just like the fate of a single individual human, concerns events or conditions that are beyond your control and things that you cannot change or that you can only change under really special conditions and through the intervention of the supernatural. So, you know, I always speak paradoxically of fate. I say fate is that which cannot be changed, so love your fate. But then I say it can be changed, and I do that intentionally because I am mingling the transmission to you with the circuits of your NLP in a particularly delicate manner. Now, the fate of humanity, well, how would we fucking know? The only way we know what the fate of humanity is by considering the trajectory of the sacred narrative. Now, there are two events that happen in the sacred narrative that are out of human control. They are fateful events, aren't they? They are events in the realm of the aeons of fire, but they have a tremendous impact upon human experience in this experiment. These fateful events deeply impact the way that we humans come to the divine experiment, come to understand it, as well as the way that we can fulfill ourselves within it according to her designs and purposes from the original pleromic perspective. The first event is the generation of the archons, also called the generation of error. So we have the archons intruding upon this experiment that was not part of the way it was initially set up. Second event, also due to the Mother Goddess, the shearing of the Anthropos template, resulted in a long-term effect, or produced a long-term effect, and you know what that is. We call it the gender rift, R-I-F-T. So there are two massively generically fateful conditions bearing upon the Anthropos in this experiment. The presence of the Archons and the shearing of the Anthropos template, producing the gender rift, which is the basis of the battle of the sexes and also What's worse, the basis of the fall of humanity into meiotic reproduction. Meiotic reproduction is fate. And how does that work out? Well, you know, sometimes I go a long ways around the barn to collect the eggs, don't I? How does it work out that the shearing of the Anthropos template throwing us into meiotic reproduction determines your fate? Because your fate is biological. And how many people have observed that? How many people have made that observation? Freud, in his crude manner, said, anatomy is fate. What he meant by anatomy, because he was an anatomist, he was a brain, he dissected brains when he was in his student years. Anatomy means your given, received, biological, genetic instrument. That is your fate. You cannot change the shape of your nose. You cannot change if you have big bones or small bones. You cannot change those things. You could if you were in meiotic mode, or excuse me, mitotic mode, and had full access to the epigenetic circuitry of RNA and DNA, which has been shunted by the archons. If you had full access without the shunt, you could epigenetically make your nose be anything you wanted it to be. You could grow a different shaped nose. Okay? Some animals exhibit this epigenetic capacity for self-shaping, as you know. But we're not in that state, folks. We're facing a fate, and it's a hard fate. And we can't change that fate without the goddess herself, who got us into it in the first place. So that brings us to this moment. And I guess I would venture to say that, yeah, maybe, sure, this extraordinary configuration of July 7th, the lunar apogee, with the sunrise crescent of Idris, the location in the perihelion of Saturn, Jupiter locked into the same point, and Saturn, whose perihelion is implicated in the constellation, stationary at a point in the zodiac at the knees of the Virgin, about 3 degrees from Kambalia, the alchemist's star. Now, there is your picture. There is your picture. And written on that picture is the question. If the Aeon Sophia were able to combine her first and second attention in an act of divine alchemy, would the human animals in her experiment be able to join her in that moment in her correction? And would they be able to realize in some enduring manner the way that she proclaims her Magnificat? That's the question that is now vibrating through this planet. And I leave you with that question to pick up that theme in the next NAV briefing.